Hello, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I cannot believe there are so many people in this room. I so badly I walked, you know, by the other few talks left, and there's hardly anyone in the room, so that's everybody's at the beach if they're still here. So you guys get an award. But this is going to be a really exciting session. Really exciting. And we're doing something new, patterned after what they've been doing. They started it at EB, and they did it at ISMNPAW this year. I was fortunate to go to Cape Town, and I saw this. So it's called a lightning talk. So people have 5 minutes, that's it. And they have to give you the highlights, the important stuff. Not their methods, but what message do they want you to take from their research? And the folks selected have done stellar work, and they're at the end of their AFRI grant. So most of them, I guess, are in year five if they had a five-year grant. So I'm going to introduce everyone. And I forgot to tell you, my name's Marilyn Townsend. I think I know most of you, but if I haven't met you, please introduce yourself to me. So our terrific speakers are going to be, Sharon Donovan, who's not here. And she is being represented by Margarita Turan, and that's University of Illinois. And Marion Fitzgibbon, who is down here on the end, University of Illinois. University of Illinois is highly populated here today. From Baylor, Cheryl Hughes, right here. And from University of Michigan, Holly Brophy Herb is representing Julie Lemay. And Jessica Mandering is right here. And we won't be hearing from Janice Emerson. And I haven't seen Deborah John. Oh, I'm sorry. All right. We're going to have a problem in terms of space. Okay.
I can see better from here.
Yeah, you're right. Okay, so we'll be calling you, Deborah. Nice to meet you. All right, let's start. And based on how the slides went in there, I know Carol Brenner is doing two talks simultaneously, and she'll be coming in to give hers and then going back to her other place. And I think she's the first person on the slides. Right? So we're going to have to skip ahead. Do you know who's handling the slides? Yeah, you're right. Good point. Okay, so let's go ahead and change.
Last day. I'm going to talk about the successes that we have at the Illinois Transdisciplinary Obesity Prevention Program, and in short, it's called the ITO program. Which one is the one? Okay. our goals in the program, and I'm going to talk about only goals one and two. The one is about educating a cohort of transdisciplinary scholars that will have an MPH and a PhD. And this was very important to have the transdisciplinary element integrated in the PhD program. I'm not going to talk about the second goal, about the visiting faculty, but what is important is the metrics we use to assess the faculty and scholars, the transdisciplinary knowledge and attitudes they have during the time of their training. So we, in that sense, we have to go in goal number one, and you can see here, is the students that we were able to educate, they will have a transdisciplinary program. That uniqueness is to go first to the MPH program, the Master's in Public Health. The first challenge was to assemble a transdisciplinary team of investigators, and we were able to be fortunate to have been working before in a group called Strong Kids for researching in a multidisciplinary way and a transdisciplinary way the problem of obesity. And our team, you can see here, is a very complex and big team. We have 9 departments represented, and we won the 2015 award from the College of ACES. On top of that, we were able to train 11 scholars. And interesting part is that they come from different undergrad institutions with different philosophy. They were admitted in 5 different doctoral degree programs, and the advisory team, the committee that was advising these PhD students, was represented from 11 departments. So this is interesting because the students were getting a variety of experiences. This first part was to establish the program and the curricula. And the Master's in Public Health curriculum was already established at the university. And after completing the curricula, they were doing the practicum. And importantly, they were assigned to, and I don't know if I have a pointer here. I don't see a pointer, but I don't hope you can see my arrow there, no. Well, the Master's of Public Health program is the core of the center of this project. And we have 6 departments. And we were establishing transdisciplinary courses that were allowing the students to get the focus of obesity, childhood obesity, from different disciplines, including nutrition, nutritional science, social work, human development and family studies, community health, and kinesiology. So as you can imagine, the students were able to get variety of experiences and topics explained to them from different points of view, and different scholars were getting opportunities, many opportunities to explore what does it mean to do transdisciplinary research. And as we know, the complex problem of obesity couldn't be solved with only one discipline. I hope I go to the next one here. So, for the goal number 3, the metrics. How do we assess if somebody's learning, getting a different change in attitude, and doing an output that is not only the traditional output of measuring publications, presentations in public forums, or just traditional knowledge? We were having the great opportunity to do a mixed models evaluations, doing methods of qualitative and quantitative research. We were able to switch these models and allowing the students to explain what they were changing over the time of the education at baseline every year at the completion, and we plan to follow them at the postgraduate level. We are not only evaluating the students, we're also evaluating the faculty, because this is important to know that how our perceptions as faculty is changing by educating these scholars and getting feedback in a bidirectional way. So, what was the part that were having benefits and drawbacks from the program? And as you can see here, there were 6 topics that they were coming up very easily in what is good for everybody and what could be not so good for everybody. And the important thing is that many of them were able to really appreciate the ability to get different ways of thinking, how to learn, how to really build up the partnership that would last probably for many, many years after they graduate. And also they have this, you know, group, the team group, team sense of the students and the professors was very good of building that group of towards the knowledge and trying to tackle the obesity problem. Of course, part of the drawbacks is to see, well, what is my specialty? Where am I going to get a new job? What is going to be, you know, the having a dual degree? What is going to happen with the, you know, time? When am I going to have time to do my own research? What is my own part of the research? Or part of the faculties, what does administrators measure of promotion and tenure packages? What it means an advance for them? So this is part of what we were always part of the drawbacks that has to do with a new program. I believe that is important part of this is that the group feels very satisfied with how we were able to accomplish many of these goals. And in part of the assessment, and this is a traditional assessment, is to have how many publications we're having for students and who are what is the impact of those publications. And you can see here over there is that the scholars having presented 121 posters and oral presentations in 36 different meetings. And I don't have here the names of the types of meetings they have, but they're very transdisciplinary meetings, not only related to obesity or nutrition or kinesiology. Really, they have the opportunity to affect several fields of research. We're published 49 manuscripts, and you can see there is a statistical significant difference in how many co-authors for publications, how many different departments were participating in those publications, and moreover, the impact at the level of the public and the citations that we're getting for publication. And I think this is an important element over here. So the outreach is great for the group. Of course, we want to have more money to follow the students and to have, you know, the opportunity to have new places for where they place to them, how to get more funding to continue with the students, and how to continue with the opportunity to have new lessons to new graduate programs that will able to establish this project for obesity prevention. And I don't know if you have more questions, but we're going to be at the end of this.
We'll shift now to accommodate our star who's in two places at once. Thank you so much for coming. My name is Carol Bird-Rabiner. I'm from Rutgers University, and I want to give you a quick overview of our Home Styles project. Before I start, I just want to acknowledge that our partners are, of course, Rutgers University, University of Arizona, and we work with a grantee in New Jersey called Prevent Child Abuse New Jersey, which is the overall umbrella organization that includes Healthy Families America and Parents as Teachers. And those are two organizations that run the home visitation programs in our state for very, very high-risk families. And they were some of the families who participated in Home Styles. So Home Styles, to give you an overview of it, is in English and Spanish, as you saw with our little logos there. And it is designed to enable and motivate parents of preschoolers to shape their home environments and their lifestyle and behavioral practices, so that they can help their kids grow up in healthy ways. So it's promoting optimal child health and growth and optimal child weights. And you can see, let me see, it's just going to progress. There we go. What we wanted to do is come up with solutions for parents that were quick and easy. We know they're super busy. They need to be low cost or no cost solutions, and they need to be something they could do every day. So we were looking for them to identify their home environment and what they could do in their home environment and lifestyles and changes that they could make. When we started Home Styles, we had a very clear idea of the feel we wanted it to have. We wanted to be intensive because we knew parents are super busy. We wanted to be able to deliver each message in 15 minutes or less. It needs to be interactive and it needs to be engaging, because we know there are so many things out there vying for parents' attention that we could lose their attention really fast. So we wanted to make it entertaining for them. We wanted to also be warm, caring, and fun, because when we did our early focus groups, parents told us what was really important to them, their quality of life. The way they defined it was they wanted closer families and they wanted them to be, their children to be happy. Healthy was important, but they really wanted happiness and closer families. So we wanted to focus on that and deliver on that. We wanted to be non-judgmental. Parents carry a lot of guilt, and there's a lot of media out there that sometimes gets in the way, and we wanted to be positive as well. And as I said before, parent-defined quality of life issues were really important for us. We worked very methodically in developing the Home Styles program. We looked at all those key obesity prevention guidelines from CDC, dietary guidelines, White House, all kinds of them, and we wanted to make sure we were responsive to all of them. We used research evidence. We built a research library of evidence, more than 1,000 articles. We wanted to make sure we were totally congruent with the current research out there. We had an expert panel of incredible experts who were so willing to give their time, from psychology and child development to nutrition to physical activity and exercise physiology. We even included our graphic artist in our expert panel, because we wanted to make sure she understood the look and feel and how we wanted to progress with this. And it was a really important and key step for us. CBPR principles all the way through. We met with parents every step of the way, so it would be totally responsive to what they wanted, and we really listened to them and tried to be responsive to what they wanted. Adult learning theory was very important to us as well, because you all know that adults learn very differently than children, and we really wanted to be respectful of the way that adults, parents learn. Social cognitive theory constructs were very important to us as well, and they are incorporated very strongly throughout the curriculum that we use, the Home Styles that we develop. Behavior change strategies, we used a variety of those, really focusing on self-regulation, goal setting, so that parents can think forward about what they would like and how they would like to get there. And we also use motivational interviewing. If you're not familiar with motivational interviewing, it really helps parents to think about, or clients, whomever they might happen to be, think about goals and why they might want to achieve those goals and what might get in the way, and how to help them to resolve ambivalence associated with that. As far as we know, this is one of the very first to use in a written curriculum motivational interviewing. And we think it's really made quite a difference with our families. There are 12 main guides that are in this project that focus on 12 main topics. Most of the topics focus on healthy eating, and you can see the topics here, fruits and vegetables, fuss-free eating, breakfast, and so on. We also talked about active playtime, and it was very much based in family playtime. Exercise is not so fun when you think of that word, but we wanted to be fun, and we wanted parents to get out there and play, role model observational learning with their kids. And we also incorporated getting enough sleep. I think we're all aware that sleep has really emerged as a very important component when it comes to weight management. Another message that we had that was in each and every one of these guides was talking about child advocacy, for parents to be able to talk to their child caregivers about what they want for their children related to healthy eating, physical exercise, and nap time, or even bedtime if it was someone who was caring for the child at sleep time. We found many parents really didn't have the words or the dialogue to be able to use to talk to their child caregivers to express what they wanted. So we wanted to give them some phrasing that they could use and build their self-efficacy when it comes to talking to those who are caring for their children about what they would like. So we did this in English, and we also did this in Spanish. Every one of these guides was then again cognitively tested with Spanish audiences to make sure that they were congruent with their cultures and their language as well. These are four-page mini magazines, I should tell you, so they look just like something that might be in a magazine that a parent would pick up. Our graphic artist just really took our typewritten words and turned them into something very engaging, and we've gotten very great feedback from parents related to these. Just to give you an idea about what the materials are in Home Styles, there are 12 guides. 30 seconds. Okay, there are 12 guides, and they come with a tracker, and this helps parents set goals. There are enhancements to help them engage in behavior. This is related to portion sizes, We had motivational nudges, and we have this really beautiful website that has all the materials. These guides, the way it works is parents review a guide, they think about the changes they'd like to make, they set some goals, and they work toward them, and then they choose a new guide. I'm almost out of time, I'm gonna speed this up even faster. Home styles delivery, it can be independent learning, individual counseling sessions, home visits, group classes, and the guides are available in printed format like these. We also have it in an ebook format. They can be emailed, and they can be used as handouts. So there's lots of ways they can be used. These are just a few quick quotes about what parents are saying. I like it because it gives me fun ideas. It really helped my family. It helps me be a role model for my daughter. It's guilt-free. I like knowing about the other changes that families make. If other people can do it, I can do it too. I like the remember part. It made a big difference for us, and I love it. So we're very pleased to tell you more about it. These websites here, you can learn a lot more about how the project unfolded. And you can always contact me at either this website or at Rutgers, and I'd be more than happy to tell you about it. We have a session going on down the hall. If you'd like to stop by after this one's over, we have some ebooks that you can take home with you in English and in Spanish. Okay, sorry it went over. Thank you very much.
So I'm going to talk, can you hear me? I'm going to talk about our family-focused child obesity prevention program that was funded by USDA in 2011. Oops. Okay, so we call this Strategies for Effective Eating Development, or SEEDS. And we're in the third phase of our program right now. Phase one, during phase one, we coded videotapes on 145 Head Start family dinner meals. This was based on a previous USDA-funded project that we had that started in 2006. This was done with Head Start families. So we had 145 Head Start families times three dinner meals. It was a lot of coding. So during the first year of this project, we spent more time. We've had three different funding opportunities to do this coding. So we coded the videotapes. In this previous study, we also had digital photos of the mother's and child's meal. And we also took recipes. So we analyzed the data on the portion sizes and what the parents were serving their children and what they ate during the dinner meals. And then we also conducted focus groups in order to follow up this observational data both on the meals and on parent-child interactions. During phase two, we used the current literature, our observational data, and the focus groups to inform the development of the curriculum for our SEEDS project. And in phase three, we pilot tested this in two states, in Washington and Texas, and then we implemented the RCT, which is ongoing. We are now this fall in the final phase of the eighth trial in Houston and the eighth trial in Washington State. Okay, so I'm going to talk just very briefly about our program structure and content. So we have seven sessions, groups of 8 to 10 families. We have a separate parent and child session. These go on simultaneously. And then we have family sessions afterwards where the parent and child come back together and have a meal. Parent sessions target 5 content areas. This is in addition to an introductory session and also a final session where they have a graduation. The 5 targeted content areas are trying new foods, promoting internal cues of hunger and fullness with their children, portion sizes, appropriate portion sizes for these 3 to 5 year old children, the structure of the environment, that is outside influences that may impact your eating or your children's eating, and structuring the home environment, and that has a lot to do with family meals. And then as part of this, the parent sessions, we actually developed fun and engaging videotapes that are used, are presented to the parents, and this helps them to enhances the curriculum, but also encourages more discussion and behavior change. So the child sessions, all of this work is, or much of this work is based on some work that Susan Johnson, who is a co-investigator here, had done previously. We're focusing on 2 content areas, internal cues and also novel foods. So the internal cues, you can see a picture here of the dolls. This is something that Susan had come up with before we crafted these dolls. And the 3 dolls have Velcro stomachs filled with sand at varying levels. And the idea is to help children know to learn when they are full and communicate that to their parents. And the small stomachs help the children to be able to verbalize and understand what it means to be full or hungry and to develop a vocabulary around that. And the novel foods, the hope is to get children to be receptive to exploring new foods. So we introduce a new food each week and then use a tasting method that has been developed before for preschoolers. The idea is to get them to explore these foods, to lick it, to smell it, and do a number of things, so hopefully they will actually try those foods. So Marilyn had asked me to do some preliminary results, and so most of this at this point is based on parent report, but and it's based on 98 prevention and 90 control. So I think that we had 6 trials at the time in Washington and 4 in Houston. So what we found was that from pre to post, our prevention parents reported higher responsiveness during feeding, that is being responsive to their children's individual differences in eating compared to the controls. From pre to post, the prevention parents also reported more monitoring, more promoting internal control of eating, and this is having to do with internal cues and offering new foods compared to the controls. And then finally, our prevention from pre to post-test, our prevention parents reported less pressuring the children to eat, which is really good because in our observations, that's all the parents did was pressure their children to eat during their 20-minute meal. We also found no location effects between Texas and Washington, indicating that the program is working equally well for both sites. So that's basically it. I'd like to acknowledge USDA for funding us, and hopefully next year I'll be able to give more results.
Okay, we're going to do this again.
Hello, I'm Jessica Mandring, and I'm going to share a little snapshot with all of you today of the work that we've been doing at South Dakota State University and the University of Nebraska-Lincoln over the last 5 years to create a graduate certificate program in transdisciplinary childhood obesity prevention. And we call it TOP for short because it is a mouthful. So the goal of our group was to bring together faculty and extension personnel across a wide variety of disciplines to create an innovative graduate certificate program that would prepare students to be able to go out and work in diverse teams and prevent childhood obesity once they were done with their graduate degrees. And when we created our program in 2011, we created it as a graduate certificate program. So it was a certificate that students who were already degree seeking in terms of a master's degree or a PhD could earn this degree in, or earn this certificate in addition to their degree. We thought that would allow us to make it a little bit more feasible to involve a variety of disciplines and students from across our campus. Since the program conception in 2011, we've had 31 students graduate with a master's or PhD degree and this TOP certificate from a really wide variety of disciplines, which you can see on the list at the bottom of the slide. And the program has grown in popularity every year, which we think is a good thing. There's been a lot of good word of mouth, and right now we have 41 students currently en route to earning the certificate. When we first came together, we really felt strongly that we wanted to create a curriculum as part of this certificate that had a really strong educational component, which is what our graduate students were used to, right? But we also really wanted to make sure that it had a strong extension component. We wanted to give our students experience not only learning the concepts about childhood obesity prevention, but taking those concepts to practice and working with our extension personnel at South Dakota State University and the University of Nebraska-Lincoln to gain experience in the field of community-based childhood obesity prevention. And in addition, we also wanted to expose them to research. And so I'm going to talk to you just really briefly about what we did in each of those areas. For the education component, we created 7 unique core credits as part of our certificate program. These had student learning outcomes focused in gaining knowledge in the areas of best practices in childhood obesity prevention. But we also included a lot of student learning objectives that were consistent with interprofessional education standards and teaching students how to work in transdisciplinary teams. Because we know that that's beneficial, but we really know that the research shows that students don't have the skill set to know how to work well and how to work effectively together. So we really wanted to help them build that. I'm just giving you a snapshot of some of our annual course evaluation data here. But we've seen that our curriculum really does have a significant impact on our students. We've seen a great improvement after the curriculum in their confidence and their ability to understand perceptions from other disciplines and to know what other disciplines do and what they have to offer, to be able to think critically about childhood obesity prevention issues and to be able to present best practices based on the literature. In addition, students improved in their confidence and their ability to be able to work effectively with teams, which we think is a big win. In addition, for that extension component that I talked about earlier, all of our students are required to go out and work collaboratively with the strong extension programs at our universities and get hands-on experience out in the community. And overwhelmingly, our students come back and say this is their favorite part of the program. They talk a lot through personal interview data with our alumni about how this made such a difference in their ability to get jobs. And their ability when they went out into the workforce to say, you know, we're not working with all the disciplines we should be, and we need to get other people at the table. So this has been a huge asset for our program, and our students are gaining a lot of experience in a variety of childhood obesity prevention areas. In addition, we give our students research experience through thesis projects, grant writing, and we've had a number of successful research outcomes. We've been able to provide research assistantships, professional development opportunities, bring in speakers, support student research through seed grants, And although the majority of our students are only master's degree seeking, they've been very successful in disseminating their work through posters and oral presentations, as well as peer-reviewed abstracts and manuscripts. And last but not least, throughout the duration of our program, we've been evaluating the impact of our program on student perceptions and attitudes regarding teamwork, collaboration, and the value that our students see in interprofessional education. And actually, in 2013, we were recognized by the National Center for Interprofessional Practice and Education, which is housed at the University of Minnesota, for our innovative work in this area. And we now partner with them to help inform at a national level best practices for interprofessional education. And the reason they looked at us and said we were innovative, which we didn't necessarily recognize, is because we had our students out doing interprofessional education in a community, and the majority of interprofessional education programs are focused in a clinical setting. In addition, we were at a land-grant institution, and we kind of blew their mind with the professions that we had included in our program. So they're not typical healthcare providers, not all of them. And the majority of these interprofessional education programs that partner with the National Center are housed at medical schools. So our group is really now hoping to move this forward and work to inform best practices for interprofessional education at land-grant institutions. And it's been a really great experience. So a special thank you to USDA for the ability to set up this program, which is going to continue for years to come and benefit students at our respective universities, and to the co-investigators who make it possible. Thank you.
I'm Holly Brophy Herb from Michigan State, filling in for Julie Lumie, who sends her apologies. She had a last-minute family issue, so I'm delighted to be here for her, but I know she wishes she could be here. So our project was recently completed. It was called Enhancing Self-Regulation as a Strategy for Obesity Prevention and Head Start Preschoolers, collaboration between University of Michigan and Michigan State. So we collaborate in research, not in sports. So the idea was to really think about self-regulation as an obesity prevention strategy, really built on existing literature that suggests that children with behavior problems, children with difficult temperaments, children with poor inhibitory skills, poor delay of gratification skills, tend to be obese. So there's a greater prevalence of obesity among children with these kinds of behavior problems. So that really led to our idea of thinking about enhancing self-regulation as a way to promote obesity prevention and lower the prevalence of obesity, with the idea that if you can enhance self-regulation skills, you can reduce impulsive eating, emotional eating, and then that in turn would relate to better obesity outcomes. And so that's what our study was built on. So we called it the Growing Healthy Study. It's a community-based randomized controlled trial conducted between 2011 and 2015, so we just recently completed it. We enrolled 697 preschoolers who were randomized to one of three groups that I'll talk about in just a second. This is a great collaboration with some long-standing Head Start programs with whom we've collaborated for a long time, so we're really fortunate to have such great community partners. In essence, we tested three study arms that I'll talk about in a second, comparison group, and then we had these two interventions that we tested. One is POPS, which is the Preschool Obesity Prevention Series. It was built on a curriculum developed by my colleague Mildred Horodinsky and I and a number of other people, but certainly led by Millie's great work, that really focused on increasing the intake and frequency and variety of fruits, of vegetables, decreasing sugar-sweetened beverages, reducing screen time, focusing on healthy meals at home, including information on portion sizes for young children. And we also included the Incredible Years. The Incredible Years curriculum is by Carolyn Webster Stratton. It's a very well-known intervention program designed to enhance children's self-regulation skills. It's got a very strong evidence base. It's been tested in childcare settings, Head Start settings, elementary school settings, which is why we elected it to include it in our study. So again, it kind of focuses on both behavioral and emotion regulation skills, as well as emotional awareness and general social skills. So with that in mind, we had three study arms. So we had Head Start as usual, which served as our comparison group. We had Head Start plus POPS, so that's the nutrition, education, obesity prevention component. And then we had our third group, which was really this combination of POPS, which is the obesity prevention, nutrition, education, paired with the enhancement of children's self-regulation via the Incredible Years program. And our hypothesis was that it was this combination group. We called it the Cadillac model, so they got everything. They got the nutrition part, they got the behavioral part. Our hypothesis was that that group would show the strongest response to the intervention, so strongest intervention effects. So 690 children available for analyses. Each component, both POPS as well as the IYS, had a parent component for the classroom as well as a parent component. So parent sessions in the evenings or afternoons, whatever time was good for parents, and then classroom teachers delivered curriculum as well. POPS also included curriculum delivery by our MSU Extension educators who worked closely with classroom teachers, and they also delivered the POPS parent curriculum. IYS was facilitated by a master's trained mental health specialist who worked closely with the teachers. And so children were randomized, parents were randomized to one of these three groups. We looked at, as our primary outcomes, the prevalence of overweight and obesity, BMI Z scores. We also looked at children's self-regulation skills. And then secondary outcomes included dietary quality, so fruit and vegetable intake, sugar-sweetened beverage intake. We used a 24-hour diet recall for that. We also looked at children's outdoor playtime, their screen time, computers, TVs, handheld devices, all that good stuff. We also looked at parents' nutrition knowledge and nutritional self-efficacy. Okay, so the bummer was there were no intervention effects on obesity prevalence or overweight prevalence across the sample. There were improvements in self-regulation, especially for that Cadillac model group, and there was a decline in sugar-sweetened beverages for that Cadillac group. So no other effects, but because we knew that this prior work showed links between self-regulation and obesity, we reran some of the final analyses stratifying on children's initial baseline self-regulation skills at the start of the study. And we found that for children with fewer behavioral problems in the beginning, so kids with higher self-regulation skills, did show a decline in obesity prevalence from start to finish, from pre to post. And they also showed the decline in sugar-sweetened beverages. For kids with high self-regulation to begin with, the intervention seemed to be somewhat effective there. We think there's a couple of reasons why that might be. Sorry about that. So for kids with low self-regulation skills, it may be that parent investment is super important. Across both IYS and POPS, parent participation was very, very low, and that may have been really problematic for kids who had poor self-regulation skills to begin with in terms of making any kinds of dietary changes at home. It may be that we need more time to show effects, and it may be that the dual focus on self-regulation and obesity prevention attenuated the effects of both. So our conclusion in this randomized controlled trial that we did see a change in obesity prevalence, but only for children with high self-regulation skills. Thank
Okay, thanks very much. I know this day is coming to an end, so I'll stay within my 5 minutes here.
Okay, I'm going to be talking about an adaptation of our original. I'll start with this slide, though, first. One of the reasons that I went into prevention research of obesity is because for years, maybe 15 years, I was director of the eating disorder and obesity program. And I think the discouragement I saw over the years, not only from the clinicians that were treating people, but the patients themselves. So I think there was a place for treatment. Obviously, we have to continue to treat people, but I got involved with prevention, and particularly prevention in preschool children, so that we can actually have children grow into a healthy weight and the trajectory stays normal rather than excessive weight gain. So that really has been my work over the last 15 to 20 years. We know about the issues, particularly with minority and underserved populations. So our original program, Hip-Opt-to-Health, was a school-based in Head Start programs. And the focus of it was in schools because we felt that we were going to get, you know, more parent involvement, that there was trust in the schools, that there was no cost to parents, those types of things. And one of the reasons for this is that we wanted to get more parent involvement with our USDA funding. But the weight control intervention that we originally had, we had specially trained people go in, and it was 3 times a week for 14 weeks. It was really rather intensive, physical activity and diet. And after that, actually, we trained the teachers to do it also. But the original program was fairly intensive. And it was, I'll show these puppets in a minute. Those were our original puppets. It's based on the 3 times a week, based on puppets that go through these challenges about eating and activity. So the program was successful in this randomized trial in children not gaining excessive amounts of weight in the treatment group. So the conclusions there was that it worked, but what we really felt was we wanted to get parents more involved in how we were going to do that. So then we devised this dissemination trial, which was develop something and actually have peer educators teach it. We felt that we were not ever going to be really successful if we were having our people go in, because then the grant's over, the people that are paid, the research people leave. And then the schools are saying, but wait a minute, we really wanted it. And we're like, yeah, but there's no more money. So we decided that we were going to train peer educators. And we've had wonderful collaborations with our SNAP Ed and EdTech partners at the University of Illinois and up in Chicago, which has really been terrific. So some of the formative research, we talked to you on the phone. We talked to a variety of other people, both locally and nationally. We talked to parents, we talked to managers of FNIP programs. Really, how are we going to deliver this program in a way that was meeting the needs of both the parents and the children? And so we want to develop complementary curricula, child and parent. So we went to, I'll just show you a little bit of what we did. We had had some very expensive, but we did the efficacy child. We had some very expensive puppets. So we couldn't give them away. So this how we developed so that the kids can play with them. The parents get their version of them, but then the peer educators get them too. And these are watchable, and then people can play with them. This is Miss Fruit, and Miss Grain, and Miss Dairy, and this is Mr. Fat, and Miss Sugar. They love Miss Sugar, but we tell her we can't have much of her. And then Mr. Protein, and then Mr. Vegetable. So they get these, and then we have it for the parents and the children. And this is part of the curriculum. We developed it so that it's, you know, very easy. And also, we developed it so that the peer educators, if they went on the bus, they could bring it the very small. It's not heavy. And this tells you exactly, you know, it's very nicely done. We worked with some wonderful educators. But exactly what the objectives are and how long things take. And then we developed 2 books. It's also done all in English and all in Spanish too. So we have everything done. Who Helps You Go and Grow? And then Thomas Has a Winning Day. We developed that. And then we also developed flashcards. They could do games like concentration and those. I got 30 seconds. Okay. A bunch of blue cards that everybody really likes. Okay. These are some of the stories that the characters have. for the two books. And we've done now, we've done about 10 different sites. We're continuing to it. And also, though, just I just want to say that with some of the places that we worked with in terms of Angela Odoms Young, who's the Chicago Partnership for Health Promotion, they've now taken this and they've done a further adaptation of it, and they've also done some evaluation. So she and I talked on Sunday. Of course, we're in the same building, but we never see each other, so we had to come to San Diego to talk to each other. And so now we're going to get together to do some further evaluation, but it's been great to be able to disseminate this. So thank you for the funding. And also, you can download this for free, all the material. And I have the website.
Okay, thank you.
And our final speaker, Deborah John, Oregon State University.
Wow, I get to go last.
Thank you.
I'm Deborah John from Oregon State University, and I'm going to try in 5 minutes to tell you a little bit about a very large, interesting project. Our project was generating rural options for weight-healthy kids and communities. The goal of our project was to change the context to prevent a rise in obesity risk and prevalence in populations of rural children. And we actually had two large aims, and either one could have been a project in itself. Our first aim was to explore and model the rural obesogenic environment in Oregon and with partners in 5 western states, our land-grant university partners, in order to inform a model of rural obesity prevention, research, education, and extension. And our second aim was to intervene in Oregon to use this model via extension, targeting changes in the community, school, and family home contexts to promote children's daily healthful eating and physical activity behaviors and patterns, and thus prevent a rise in BMI prevalence in elementary school student populations. We had to develop tools in order to work with the context. We had to be able to assess the context. We had to be able to identify priority areas to intervene, and then we had to link those priority areas with evidence-based practice. So these are the tools that we developed to work at both the community level and the school level. The two community level tools, one is called HEAL Maps, Healthy Eating, Active Living, mapping attributes using participatory photographic surveys. It's a mouthful. And the other tool, which is an environmental scan tool, is the Rural Community Food and Physical Activity Environment Resource Audit. And those two tools together allowed us to engage the communities, both the residents in the community as well as the decision makers and sector partners in the community, to actually identify the resources in the community that either enabled or hindered people who live in the community's ability to eat healthy and be active every day. What we learned from HEAL Maps is that attributes of rural place, basically the accessibility, availability, and affordability of resources, are differently experienced by rural people depending on socially determined group attributes, including income, location, race, ethnicity, family size type, job, work, cultural norms and beliefs. Essentially, not all people are the same, and even though they have exposure to the same resources, they don't experience those resources the same. In the model, all of the blue areas were things that were consistently across all states reported as supports or enablers of healthy eating and physical activity. All of the red were consistently identified as barriers, and all of the gray were either sometimes supports or sometimes barriers, depending on the group identity. So if you belong to a low-income group, sometimes a farmer's market might actually be seen as a barrier to healthy eating. We also use this tool to evaluate community readiness, and we used a collective readiness model, not looking only at interviews from community decision makers or stakeholders, but we engaged the people who lived in the community in the conversation, and we were able to scale community readiness across all of the communities, 22 communities. We learned that collective readiness fell somewhere around pre-planning for almost all of the communities, although it varied from as low as no awareness that anything needed to be done to some communities that were in some areas of action. That let us know that communities generally were poised to do something, but they didn't know what to do. In Oregon, we applied our community food and physical activity audit tool to the environment, and what we learned through ground truth audits is that we can affect change, and this basically illustrates the kinds of changes that occurred from pre and post in our intervention communities. Increase in access to physical activity resources, an increase in access to food resources, and where we saw the biggest increase were low and no cost physical activity supports and food assistance in underserved rural communities. So what people needed, which was access to free physical activity, easily accessible physical activity, and access to food, was enabled through this intervention. We used our mapping to identify where resources needed to occur, and then we linked the gaps in resources to where new resources were supported. We measured changes in the school environment, and basically the changes in the school environment enabled our schools to provide easy access to physical activity every day and to be consistent with easy access to healthy eating opportunities. Families told us where barriers were, and those aligned very closely with the resources in the community or gaps in resources. And these are our impacts. Basically, one of our communities put together this slideshow that showed how increased access to local foods, gardens, produce, and agriculture, and fresh food assistance occurred in our communities. Access to trails, parks, public lands for active recreation and learning. Increased access to school supports via shared use agreements, active play, fitness, and learning resources. Increased access to programs and partners that support weight healthy lifestyles. What we didn't have was any change in obesity risk or prevalence over 3 years in the community, which we wouldn't expect. Many of these new resources took almost 3 years to put into place. For the first time in history, and we all know this, that today's kids may live 5 years less than their parents. And the question we pose to our communities is, what will you do with five more years? What you saw is what they told us that they would continue to do. And that's it. Thank you.
These were all exciting, weren't they? Really exciting. Thank you, all of you. I'm looking at the clock, and somehow an entire hour flew by with our lightning talks. So please feel free to get up and leave. But for those of you who would like to stay for 10 minutes of questions, please do so. But please feel comfortable to leave. So do we have some questions? And while you're thinking of your questions, I would love to ask. Here's the first question to sort of get you thinking here. We had two grants that focused on educating college students at different institutions, different types of training. I'd like to hear from both of you on what advice you have for other institutions interested in submitting an AFRI grant under that category, under the training category. So would both of you?
Can everyone hear me if I just talk from here? I think I have a couple of my colleagues in the room that work on the project with me as well. But I think the first thing that comes to mind for me, at least, is that to not reinvent the wheel. To talk to those of us who have done it, we learned a lot of things along the way about things you need to think about at your institution, about all of the disciplines on campus that you'd like to get involved in, if it's going to be feasible for them, you know, things from how much a credit costs, and if they can take those courses as electives, if you want to set it up as a degree program or a certificate program, and how to get those students involved and to know about your program, because higher academia is not set up to facilitate cross-disciplinary learning. You know, grad students come to campus and they're taking what their advisor tells them to take, they need to take to get their degree. And so we learned a lot along the way about things we wish we would have known in year one about how to make that happen, but my advice would be to say reach out.
Margarita.
Yes, I will agree with you. And I also, some of the students are here, and we have both the grad program and the undergrad program experiences. And the important thing is to have a team integrated, so the professors are doing those courses, talk to each other, because that facilitates the conversation. And the other part that is very important is the institutional support, so the administration knows what to have and how much power it gives to the students to have a transdisciplinary training. And how much value, which is, if you think about this, at delaying satisfaction. It's sometimes to reach out to full potential, but if all things integrated and health plan and they talk to each other, really has a wonderful opportunity for everybody.
Thank you. Another question? Yes.
So for the people who did preschool interventions, like everybody, I'm just curious of how you got be involved and like lessons learned, what worked and didn't work to get, and what level of involvement.
Well, I think the primary issue for parents is make it easy for them and support them. We went to a lot of effort to have focus groups with parents, what they wanted, what they thought was going to work. So there was a lot of acceptability of the program. Now we've seen that there are some preliminary behavior changes, but I think what we found with other ones, you know, we haven't moved the BMI, and I think that maybe that's just too much to ask for any kind of a short-term intervention, given that you're not dealing with a person's entire life, you're not dealing with the environment, the community, that type of thing. But it's make it easy and make them feel supported.
Our parent participation rate was really low, and we provided childcare, meals, transportation. We tried to provide as many of the concrete resources as we could, but it was still hard because parents were working all different shifts, you know, and some were working two jobs, so there was no way that they could come. So I think those were really tricky issues for us, and I don't think that we found good ways to necessarily address those fully, although we tried to use the new strategies to help someone.
Any other questions? Yes.
This is actually for you, Deborah. I saw in your paper when you had your barriers and enablers that active transport was great at. Could you say a little bit more about how in different circumstances of the barrier?
Mm-hmm. So when active transportation is perceived to be available in a community, but you don't have access to those active transportation supports, then essentially the expectation that you're going to use active transportation is embedded kind of in
we provided these resources, why aren't you using? Mm-hmm. But the reality is, if you're talking about rural areas and true access, those aren't within even a half mile of where most people live. Mm-hmm. And so it exists in the community. It tends to be a resource that most often these are either connected trails or for bikes or on foot, that they tend to be visitors who use the trails. So it may bring some economic benefit to the community, but the people who live in the community don't use those resources every day, unless they have time, which means that's a resource, or if they live close enough to the trail that it actually is accessible for them.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you all very much for joining us today. And I'd like to give a special thanks to all of our speakers. We'll see you next year.